Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I think it's suitably late, so we should probably start. No, I'm running later than standard McGill time. We're over 5 minutes beyond the announced time, so I think the class is all here so we can think about beginning. So I'd just like to, for those who don't know me, my name's Dave Lowther. I'm president of MAUT this year. I'd just like to welcome everybody to the fall general meeting. Thank you for coming, and at least giving me somebody to talk to. There's a couple of sort of housekeeping announcements that I should really make. Just, I'd like to make sure that everybody has signed in. If you haven't signed in the book, can you do that before you leave, just to make sure we got a record of who was around? The second sort of announcement is, if you've got questions to ask during the meeting, can you just announce your name so we know who it is, and make sure you use a microphone for two reasons. One is we're recording the meeting, and if you don't speak into the microphone, I know some of you think you know, you all teach, so you don't need microphones, but the recording system doesn't work very well if you don't talk into the microphone. So you're really talking into it for the recording system, not for everybody standing around here. So if you could do that, and the other reason it's important, of course, is that we're internet broadcasting this meeting for all those people who couldn't actually make it, particularly McDonald campus. So if anybody's at McDonald campus, welcome. apart from ones that physically made the trip here. Okay, so that's the instructions for how we're going to run this today. And I think the first thing we have to do, our first item on the agenda, is to actually adopt the agenda. I presume everybody has I had a chance to look at the agenda, and it's up here. At least the first half is there. That's the second half. Okay, that's the agenda. Are there any changes or any items anybody would like to propose that we add to the agenda? If not, then I'd like a motion to approve. John. Okay, so we now have an agenda. Okay, the next item down here, whoops, is the, go back to manipulate this thing, minutes of the April 24th Spring General Meeting. I think that's been on the website. If everybody wants to see them, I have them on the screen here, all, whatever it is, 20-something pages of them. If you would like to see them, I'll put them up. Otherwise, if anybody's got any corrections or changes to those minutes, are there any? None. If not, then I guess we need a motion to adopt the minutes of the April 24th Spring General Meeting. Terry and the seconder, Stefano. Okay, all those in favor? Thank you. So that's passed. Okay. Now you get down to the exciting bit, which is apparently my report. So I'll go through to... It's me? Right. Okay, I've put some bullet points up here. My full report is up on the web for those of you who've had time to look at it, but I wasn't going to put the whole thing up on the screen. So I've just bulleted the major items in things that I'd like to report to you. And I'm following a sequence of things in the report that Bruce set up, I guess, last year, because it seemed to be a reasonable way of addressing what we've mostly done in the last 6 months. And I think they're in alphabetical order, which is why academic freedom comes first. So academic freedom is something we've all been worried about, and of course we produced the MAUT Declaration of Academic Freedom about a year ago, voted on it and adopted it, and we took it to the administration. The administration came back with their version of a statement on academic freedom. And what we did over the summer, since the point of time when we received that, was to recall parts of the ad hoc committee, particularly Brendan Gillen and John Galati, to work on that, and they've come up with a response to the administration's statement on academic freedom. So our comments going back to that, and just to update you, that set of comments has gone back to the principal for further discussion. So that's sort of where we are on the academic freedom issue at the moment. So that's that one. The second item that we've done a lot of work on over the last few months, and this is continuing from last year, is this whole issue of collegial government and governance, and getting involved with the administration in decisions they're making which significantly affect the faculty and librarians at the university. And we've worked on a lot of the regulations, as you all know, are under serious review. They're going through all the regulations at the moment. Lydia White spent a lot of time doing some of this stuff. And she's been replaced now by Angela Campbell. If Angela's around anywhere. Ah, Angela's there. Great. Angela's busy working on, picked up the load, and is busy working on these regulations. And we've been working with both Lydia and Angela on this, and some of the things we've looked at are looking at the rules on appeals in case of dismissal, things to do with professional licensing fees, the conflict of interest reporting policy that we brought up, I guess, in April, policy on safe disclosure, and then in the summer there was the McGill commitment document, which is on the website. The university came to us and asked us to comment on that. We felt that one, since it was already on the website, was beyond the point at which we could seriously have input to it. We may not be totally happy with it, but it's there anyhow. It can be changed, apparently, so we're looking at working on that. And the fall break, which all of you, I think many of you, if not all of you, have already given you your comments on. More recently, over the last, 4 or 6 weeks, there's been a lot of work going on the regulations concerning investigation of research misconduct. This is important to, I think, everyone in the room. Hopefully, you don't fall afoul of this thing, but having them clearly stated and look at how we how they are research misconduct is investigated is kind of important. That work's going on with a committee headed by Alan Ush, sitting down here, and talking to Angela on the. What the administration's point of view, and that's an ongoing. That document is oscillating right now between MAUT and the administration, and hopefully will converge at some point fairly soon. It's been delayed. It was due to go through Senate relatively soon, but it's been delayed because of all the comments that have been coming back on it. So those of you on Senate won't see this document, I think, until sometime in the new year. In addition to that, the three presidents, that's the past president or president-elect and myself, meet with the principal and the provost fairly regularly for informal discussions on issues that you bring up to us. If you want stuff to go straight to the principal, the way of doing that is to tell us what you want us to discuss next time we sit down with them. And these meetings take place about once every 4 or 5 weeks. So we've got a direct line in there, and some of those have had some significant effect on the way the administration is behaving. What else? Recently, you know, we were asked for input on the international strategy document. That's also been presented in Senate and discussed in the Senate, and we are going to be submitting our input on that by December the 1st, and we'll publicize that to members of MAUT as soon as we've got a response back together. And the last one, the latest one, well, I guess I'm not sure whether this survey has gone out yet, but there is a survey coming out on the cyclical review of the Information Technology Services Group. We've been asked for input through our members. And we're going to mention this again under our other business, but we would like any information, any views anybody's got on information technology around here and the services that are provided so we can feed that back through the cyclical review process. To make all this work, we now have a process for ad hoc consultation at MAUT, which seems to be working quite well. And again, if anybody wants to see that process, it's an available document on the website, so you can see how we're doing this. So that's that piece. The next item was academic salary compensation. John? Back to page two, okay. Forward to page two. The next one. This one is. This is the second half of my report. Okay, that was the first. Okay. Committee on Academic Salary Compensation. That committee has met twice so far this semester and is due to keep meeting through the academic year. At the moment, we're pretty confident that the commitment for the increase next June, which was agreed to 2.5 years ago, will be upheld. The administration has said that it will uphold that agreement, even though it's got budgetary issues and everything else. It's keen to keep that in place. And we're starting discussions on the next 3-year salary policy. And hopefully by the time we get to the end of this academic year, maybe by April, we'll have something to report on that. And then the last item on my agenda here is entitled MAUT Business. That's stuff that's been going on internally in MAUT. Well, not totally internally, because one of the biggest discussions we've been having over this semester is the relationship of MAUT with the McGill University Retirees Association. And maybe Gary will talk a bit more about that when he does his report from the retirees section. For many of those of you who don't know, over the summer, I guess an association has been put together to try to bring together all the retirees from McGill, not just the faculty, but everybody who's ever worked at McGill and has retired from here, and to build that into a single association that they hope will have some ability to work with the administration on retirees' issues. And that, of course, is an issue for MAUT as well, because we have our retirees section, and how these two pieces are going to work together is something we're still contemplating. The fall break survey, thank you all for completing that. It was, like I said, a request. The administration came to us and said they're looking at a fall break. And the major reason for looking at this thing is the students' mental health. Apparently, all students having find it very difficult to run through the whole 13 weeks because of the stresses that we place on them. So the idea is to do what a lot of other universities have done and add in a break point around about halfway through the semester, just before midterms, to give the students a chance to recover before they hit midterm exams. And so thank you for all your input on that. That was actually quite informative. We wanted to go back and see how many people were keen on a fall break and what you would be willing to pay in order to get it. In other words, starting earlier, exams on weekends, and other issues. So thank you for the feedback. That's been extremely useful. We've also cleaned up, thanks to Mark's input, we've done a lot of work to clean up the constitution that's on the web, and we believe that what's now on the web actually accurately reflects the MAU constitution as it now stands. It's been updated to take into account changes that were put through general meetings over the last 2 or 3 years, but never actually updated on the web. So those have been updated. The bylaws have been updated as well. And in particular, there's a new bylaw being put in on donations to make it a lot clearer about who can donate how much without having to go away to a general meeting. And so if you want to read them, and it's exciting reading, they're all on the website. Okay, and then the final part of my report is just to say that we've also, as part of the sort of housekeeping cleanup issue, gone through all the committee mandates, updated them to make sure they reflect what the committees are actually doing, and have updated the membership list to get them correct. So I think that what's up there now is accurate and correct. So that's my 90-second report, because apparently we keep reports to 90 seconds these days. So if anybody's got any questions, I'm willing to field them now, or you can think about them and come back to me at the end of the meeting, but if there are any questions.
Mark Richard from Libraries. Did I understand that the revised constitution and bylaws are on the website or will be put on the website?
They will be put on the website. Thank you. Thanks, Mark. Anything else? Okay, if not, then we'll move right along. And we've got a presentation today from FQPPU on financing universities, and a particular focus on McGill, and I'd like to welcome Martin Malte from FQPPU to do this. Welcome. He promises that this won't be more than an hour or two.
Thanks, Mr. President. Thanks, David. I'm going to start slowly, even if we don't have time. I end this one, and I go on the other one. Not this one. It's down there. show it, and I'm too used to Mac now. Yeah, thanks. Firstly, I'm really happy to be with you today with my colleague Emmanuel from Université Laval. It's always a pleasure to be at McGill because when you come in, everybody's happy. And you have a warm welcoming. And it's a university I particularly love and like. So, yeah, it's a pleasure. You see, I'm going to start slowly, but I'm going to go faster and faster because I'm going to try to make a light show today, even if data regarding finances in universities is not something quite interesting for a lot of people. But we believe that it's fundamental right now to understand what's going on in universities, especially regarding these things. This is the plan presentation. You know it. Just to talk a bit about the Committee on the University Finances, the question is, we started in 2006. When I wasn't the president, I was a student slave at that time. And we first started to raise a question, because since 2000, we heard information regarding investment in universities. And all the time when we were talking to professors in universities, everybody was saying, we know that there's new money coming, but we don't see it yet. So we started to say, so where the money comes from and where it goes. So that was the starting point, starting of a long, long job. So we are still in that, but we have some data that are more interesting, and we are able to see what is going on in our universities. We presume that the finances are the true and only politic of governmental policy, actually. So, and this is really important to understand, because if you talk about something different than finances when you're talking to government people, they don't hear you, they don't understand you, and they think that you're a funny guy in somewhere or girl, and that's it. It just blows through their heads and goes somewhere else. You're not talking the same language. So you have to understand a bit of this language, so that's the reason why we are into that. So overall picture, basically there's three funds, operating, restricted, and capital assets. There's other funds, but we don't take a look at these ones right now. We are not there yet. Four sources, principle that we take a look to, from Quebec, Canada, students, and others private and everything. So usually when you look at the income, we're going up to 2011, 2012 right now, because that's the last really precise data that we can spread and get make them speak. We have more recent data, which I'll show you later on in the next 5 minutes. So this is where it goes. So incomes in Quebec University, what we have to understand, it's in 1997, most of the budget was operating 71%, and now we have at 74% incomes from Quebec universities in operating funds. Planned. Just a mistake, but that's, So expenditure, operating funds in 1997-98 was 1.9 billion for operating funds, and restricted funds was 517. So you see that now there's more money in operating funds in 2011-2012, but the question still stays, where this money's come from, or goes, or where it goes, actually. So FT, full-time equivalent students, what we realized when we started to look at more precise data is that there's a kind of unplanned growth in universities. It's not something not, well, it's really unplanned. You look at these two, you'll have the PowerPoint so you can go to these links if you're interested into this. But every time government is planning that There'll be an evolution regarding student frequentation of universities. They plan there'll be a decrease in the coming 2 years, and it never occurs since the last 18 years. So the problem is that in government right now, in Quebec's government, it's, I would say, we have more facility to predict temperature for the next 3 days than we are able to know how many students we are going to have in 3 months. So this is the... And the last dots at the end that are red are short evaluation regarding data on the fall. So it's not completely precise, but be sure we are more accurate to know how many students we have than the government is right now. So we are doing that since 10 years, and we're not doing a lot of mistakes when we check the reality after we've evaluate regarding the frequentation in the fall. So it goes from, so we are at 239,000 full-time equivalent students. And if you look at the document of Laving, we should be somewhere at 154 right now. So over 10 years, I'm not sure we would have accepted that kind of mistake in physics. But so first cycle, this is how it goes. I'm going to go a bit faster from that point. Second and third cycle, it goes hopper than the rest. So that's the most important things to see, because there's where we need the more university professor interventions. So the number of professor, this is how it goes. Actually, the last data we have comes from our unions, the unions member of the FUPPU, and others from outside, because we take the I don't know what you call that in English, pulse things. So it seems that it goes not too bad when you look at it, but when you put it on a base 100, it goes like this. So full-time equivalent student, grad and post-grads, average, and university professor. So that means that the number of full-time equivalent student per professor is going up and up. And in 95, 96, that was the time when, in fact, it's in 97, 98, there was an agreement with CREPUC, government, and QPPU to say, okay, a good point would be something like 18.5. That would be the usual and acceptable number. So we started to ask questions when we were in 2008, 2009 with our other reports when I last came in here, and we were asking questions regarding 209, 210, because there seemed to be a tendency to go up again, and since then it goes worse every year. So 54, 51, so this is the last data regarding frequentation, 51.4, and the number of professors since 97, 98, 14.7%. So you have to understand that the finances that goes in universities in Quebec from government, it's political decision. You see a trend that it goes up in this chart, but in fact, every year you see a strong variation of the amount. And even if the population increases, sometimes the money goes down. So that means that per full-time equivalent students, in constant dollars, it goes down every year. So I've put a mark there, which is the time when we changed the standard. Before that, it was administration. Since then, it's letters. Yeah. So this is the evolution of letters only, administration. And this is also the financing for teaching support that is going down also in constant dollars. So there's a 10% decrease in per full-time equivalent student that the government don't finance compared to 10 years ago. An unequal distribution, bond. We have to jump some of them. So income operating funds, source of income. So you'll be able to take a look at that if you're as pervert numbers that we are during the night at 12 o'clock when you're not sleeping. you can take a look at these and see what's going on. These sources of income, what is, no, this is Canada, Quebec. I'm going to go further. Capital asset, really fast. Capital asset, what we have to understand is most capital asset fund, and we don't have mega one because they merge all the funds in the final states, financial statement. Thank you. So they merge the funds. So we are not able right now to have the ones from McGill. We work on that. We'll find an issue for that. But right now you have everything except McGill from that point, which is around 600 million. And the point is that every year, this fund is not in deficit. So if you cut or take off the amount of money that we take from the operating fund to go in the capital asset fund, this would be every year's deficit. And the deficit would be around $200 million, excluding McGill. Yeah. So source of income for a capital asset. What is interesting is that in 1997-98, that was 24%, the yellow slides that used to come from other sources, which is operating funds. In 2012 to 2013, that was 40% of the capital asset fund, and the amount increases a lot. So the money that comes from Quebec's government didn't move over these period. And so we took the money to make buildings more to be able to bring new students in our universities. We use money from operating funds most of the time. So capital asset, McGill, here we are. So full-time equivalent students, you see McGill in a base 100 follows the national average every year. So these are in for first cycle, it's follow the same kind of path. And going to second cycle and third cycle, it's not going as fast than other universities or the average, I would say. There's a small decrease, which means for in terms of professors, you see that follows the average also, except for So with second cycle and third cycle, it has the effect that the full time equivalent student per professor is not going as hop as the other university, but it's this way, and it's also a different university because we have an important medical faculty, which is. Which make a strong difference in terms of what we need to offer in terms of student services for teaching and research. This one is interesting because that's Quebec university wages in between 97, 98, and 2011, 2012. So you see the trends. And in McGill, that's interesting because there's another trend which is there. You see the administration evolution, the blue one. And in 2009, 2010, there's been a change in the way we present final states. And you see that they use this moment because maybe there was a light on them. And they moved people that was classified in administration through support staff and others. So that changes the way we read these data. But we see it now that we have longitudinal data. So in base 100, you see the increases, how it goes. And you see, again, the down... suddenly down of the administration amount, which was at the top before 2009, 2010. So these amounts are still in, but they're spread into other jobs. Yeah, exactly that. Now that was Quebec's average in 100, and this is McGill. That speaks more. So Miguel Wedges, Bill Shears said this is how it goes. So yeah, you see the administration part from 12 to 23% in 2009, 2010. You understand that we didn't compare to 2010, 2011 because of the variation that is quite high suddenly. But it went quite up, and we believe that's still quite the same thing right now. But the real job is not the one that is classified for right now, often. So yeah, 2011, 2012. Now entrance. So since 2012, 2013. What we have to realize is there have been a first cut, 2012, 2013, 127.6. That was supposed to be something temporary, but finally it's permanent and recurrent. So another one in 2013 to 2014, 2014 to 2015, and now we are at $276 million of permanent cuts every year. In a context where we knew that there was a lack of money. Rectors used to say in 2012, 800 million. We used to say that it was unfounded data. So we make the job to calculate what was the real amount missing. And it was 249 million. So that was the reason the government at that time announced a 1,000 university professor job that didn't occur after that. So from that point, we are around $540 million missing. So really fastly, if I can have 2.5 minutes, I have to go out of the presentation. I would like to show you what we are able to minimize it. Okay. There we go. There we go. So now we are able, because we have more data. There was like the Bill 15 last year, and there was a commission. So we present a document to the commission. And we've been there. And that's the light show. That's the light show part. So this is to have a full screen, I believe. Yes. So you can find it. There's the link on the PowerPoint. I let you. At the end of the PowerPoint, you have the link. So if you're interested in the hour and a half something, I tell you there's crunchy moment in that. And this is the most crunchy in 2 minutes 30. And I tell you, it's in French, so Equator doesn't speak English yet. Or not with me. Yeah. So there you go. There we go.
Catégorie d'emploi, pour qu'on puisse, dans le fond, avoir accès à la même information que vous utilisez pour nous dire qu'il y a un enjeu actuellement d'explosion de la masse salariale des administrateurs, puis de non, puis d'un suivi, finalement, qui n'est pas équivalent du côté des professeurs. Est-ce que c'est un enjeu, vraiment, ça?
Monsieur Ombriaco.
Oui, de la bureaucratie. Pardon, Michel Ombriaco. L'enjeu est celui de la bureaucratie. On a amené ici, là, parce qu'on a essayé de faire le relevé, puis on l'a fait avec nos collègues de l'Université du Québec. Ça, en 1990, chacune des lignes, c'est ce sont les rapports que le ministère ou le gouvernement nous demandait pour répondre justement aux éléments de l'article 4. En 2012, c'est les 200 et quelques rapports qu'on doit remettre annuellement au ministère. On peut en remettre 10 autres ou 15 autres rapports, ça ne nous fait rien. Mais annuellement, c'est le genre de rapport qu'on remet au ministère. On a posé la question à savoir, est-ce que le ministère les lisait? Et un des constats qui a été fait au sommet sur l'enseignement supérieur, c'est de dire que le ministère de l'enseignement supérieur ne disposait pas des fonctionnaires ayant la compétence pour lire le rapport ou encore du temps pour répondre au rapport. On a estimé que si on abolit l'ensemble, quand on parle d'abolir de la bureaucratie, c'est ce qu'on veut dire. Si on abolit, je dirais, les deux tiers de ça qui nous apparaissent inutiles, ça ne nous fait rien de répondre à toutes les questions par catégorie d'emploi, ces choses-là. Je pense que toutes les universités vont le faire. Il n'y a aucun problème là-dessus. Mais si on abolit les trois quarts de ça qui est parfaitement inutile et que on a deux ou trois ou quatre éditions de comptes trimestrielles par année avec des questions assez simples pour répondre à vos questions, on calcule que c'est 45 à 60 millions par année qu'on sauve. Et ça, c'est facile, là. L'augmentation des masses salariales des administrateurs, on n'arrête pas de nous la justifier par la reddition de comptes supplémentaire qui est demandée. Si on arrête de faire de la reddition de comptes, je ne dis pas que la reddition de comptes, ce n'est pas une bonne affaire, il faut en faire, mais on part de ça à ça, à un moment donné, ça devient kafkaïen. Là.
Merci. J'aimerais vous rassurer là-dessus, là, il ne s'agit pas d'un rapport.
Alors, So it gives you an idea of what we're able to do right now, because after this bill, or in this bill, the idea was they wanted to include University of Quebec in the bill and maybe other universities. So or there was a door open to include other universities and control hiring people. So after that, we won that one, and they put University of Quebec and the out of the bill. So that's interesting, because now we're able to do a bit of pedagogy with our government. So we have tools, and we have argument, and we have strong data that we can show them. So one of the funny thing that I will finish with is, after that event, the opposition asked, where does this chart come from? And it comes from a report that the government has in his pocket. So we answered that, and all of the staff ran around to try to find. So you have an idea how not informed they are actually regarding universities, and we're facing strong challenges right now, and we have to explain to government the fundamental reason why we have to invest in future of our universities. That's it. Thanks.
Thanks, Martin. And just before we move on, has anybody got any quick questions? You know, we can have a couple of minutes. Ken?
Yeah. Hello. Is this? I think it's on. Martin, beautiful. Thank you very much. I just want to say how important the research work of the CFU is at FQPPU. We really respect and appreciate that. I had a question about what I thought was the most interesting fact that you showed, the administration decline in 2010, astronomical decline. Now, it's not a fact, right? It's a reporting method. So does your committee feel that the way of reporting administration before 2010 is more true, more accurate, or the way after 2010 is more true and more accurate?
We didn't take a look at what were the real changes yet, mm-hmm. Because there's not only one changes, and there's a strategic decision beside that. You have intelligent people around you, the fact that the funds are joint right now is also something that we could question, because in fact at the end of November they have to present to the government the funds separately, and they have to show capital asset fund, and they most universities are presenting it the same way in their financial statement, but at McGill's they don't do. There might be a reason why. Mm-hmm. And the movement of the administration is also something clearly there's a volunteer. What is exactly the issue? What is exactly the reason? What are the reasons? There could be not only one reason. But we have to take a look on that for sure.
I think as you say, there are a lot of strategic issues. There's an infinite amount of research you could do. But I think for us, when we look at the question of what is the cost of the administration, this is something that we need to have a feeling, like we need to have our finger on the pulse, like you said. And if there is some way for your committee to find a way to translate the post-2010 numbers, so we can look on the scale, I think this would be very useful.
Yeah,
a suggestion.
So a great report, really liked it. Do you have any sense if both the government is supporting in the, as the ratio increases between professors and students, whether that's being made up by adjuncts and or lecturers, teaching assistant, graduate students, and is there a subtle or not so subtle push by the government that would be a good thing, or that it's a good thing if professors are teaching more because that's what we do, we teach?
That's a complex, even if it seems quite a simple question. It's a simple question, but the answer is complex. There's different things. First, there's the fact that the government doesn't plan the frequentation in universities. They are facing a fact every year. And the way the money is distributed is not a financing way. You have an amount of money, you split it to the standard, and then you get your money regarding the number of students you have. So each university are always fighting for the same pot that is going down every year. So the only way to increase your finances is to or to get new students or to get students of others. But doing one or the other, you take a bigger part of the cake. So this is the fundamental problem, the way universities are financed since 2000. We are at the end of this model. So, and how universities are organizing that regarding lecturer and everything, it's not their problem. Honestly speaking, for the government, it's not their problem. They don't really care. The public idea of professor that is disseminated everywhere around Quebec right now is that we are lazy people, not working a lot, doing two courses a semester, and that's it. So, and they won on that. So right now we have to rebuild respect for university work and explain what we are doing. So that's the job we have to do. But as long as we're not going to make it, they're going to continue to try to make money with us. And the way we are organizing the answer inside our university is not really their problems. But the administration, they don't have also a strong vision of their universities, often in Quebec. So they take decision regarding 1 year, 2 year, 3 years perspective. So, yeah.
I'll be very brief. I just want to add, I've sat in on this committee for a number of years until I went on sabbatical. And I had to tell you, if you haven't been there and you don't have any financial training, which I don't, you have no appreciation of how much work has gone into this. It's absolutely astonishing. At the same time, I've been able to see the great work done by Michel Ngracchio, but also by Martin. It's really been tremendous. Thank you very much.
Myself back to where we're meant to be, which is that one, and then okay, so the next item on the agenda, this thing will go down. Let's get back up. Okay, is the auditor's report. So Pierre Gagnon will present that report for us.
And it's, there it is, sir. Hold on, you've got to wait for it to load up.
Okay.
Give it a second. There it is.
It's and part.
Yeah.
It's okay. Part of it.
Hold on.
Okay. And how to change the sheet? As you see, I'm an accountant, not a technician. But I have good news for you. So as all the good news, presentation will be short, sweet, and fast. As every year, we issue the unrestricted report. So all the supporting documentation was available, and the administration was properly made according to the association's rules. You have the income of net assets. Okay. Revenues and major expenses are a bit higher, mostly according to the indexation of salaries. There was not a penny of legal fees this year too. And the only expense which is changing according to the previous year is the change in the fair market value of the investment. And this is a point which is mostly out of the control of the administration. Some years the investment goes up, some years they are going down. So we have an excess at the end of the year of $95,000. For the assets, we had cash in banks, accounts receivable, which is the amount that the McGill University is keeping for us in our account, and the money in the money market fund. And as long-term assets, that's the mutual funds. Those are the investments who are going up and down every year. So there is only one point I can tell about the investment, about the asset, is that we need to obtain a level of fund sufficient to face a legal case as we had in the past year. If some of you are remember, a legal case like that costs between $700,000 and $800,000 of legal fees. So by the next year, I think the administration should have to maintain a level of funds sufficient to face a situation like that. Because if we didn't have the support of a related association in those years, we should have used all the money that we had in the bank. So it seems that we have money, but in my point of view, it's not sufficient to face a case that like we had in the past years. So, if you have any more question about the statement, that's all I can say. We are in a healthy situation, like every year, and this healthy situation is going more better every year. Any question? So, I was pleased to present you those financial statements. See you next year.
Okay, carrying on in the same sort of directions, things to do with money. Al Shira is going to tell us about the latest issues on the Staff Benefits Advisory Committee. And by the way, just while I'm waiting for Al to come up, if you do use the microphone, I said at the beginning, can you just say who you are so we've got it on the recording? You know, we can see you, but unfortunately the recording, video or audio recording can't, so helps.
Thanks, David. Good afternoon. Do I just press this down? There we go. So the Staff Benefit Advisory Committee is the committee that takes care of your health and dental plans. And on the committee, representing MAUT, we have three members, Edith Zurichta, who's over there, Nick Atchison, and myself. Nick, unfortunately, is not here today. In a sense, Nick represents, he's a member of MUT, but he's also a retired member of MUT and represents that contingency. So just to let you know a bit of framework for those that don't know, SBAC is a joint committee that involves all the employee groups, or almost all the employee groups, and the university administration. We entirely self-finance our plans, and so any increases that we have are because it costs us more. It's not because the university is charging us more, it's because the plan costs us more. And the premiums are related entirely to the claims. And we see those claims, we get the numbers. And the university covers half of the plan for everybody until now. However, as of next year, the retired members will be paying all of their dental costs and 70% of their health costs, whereas everybody else will still be paying 50-50. Once we agree on the premiums, it goes to the board, and the board has to sign off on this. And so SBAC is advisory to the VP of Finance, De Grappa, and he takes it to the board. As far as we know, everything is transparent, and there's no hidden expenses, and it's scrutinized by an expert consultant from Tower Watson. So, what happened this past year? We've had some increases. There's something called a large pooling amount, large amount pooling, and it's an insurance policy that if you get super large claims, over $75,000, we have a protection so that we don't have to come up with that money. But in order to have that protection, we have to pay a premium. And that premium has been going up and up and up over the years. In fact, it's almost been doubling over the last 3 years. You know, and so you might ask, well, what's the reason for that? Well, it's a number of reasons. The first thing is that we've had a couple of very large drug-related claims. And you might know that the preview for drugs may be very expensive in the future as we develop more biologicals, you know, antibody-based drugs and so on. So they could run up to hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. Now, some of that for the retired members or members over 65 might be covered by RAMQ, but maybe not all of them. And for those members that are under 65, our plan absorbs it all. So when that happens, we have to have coverage. And the other part of it is travel expenses to cover people that may have injuries or instances traveling out of the country. So they're charging us more, and I should mention the reason why they're charging us more is we've gotten away with murder. Not murder, but we've been getting about $1 million back a year for paying anywhere from $200,000 to $300,000 or $400,000. So the insurance companies are saying, well, you know, you're getting a good deal and we got to get some of it back. So they're getting some of it back. The other thing is that we've had increased drug costs and for the reasons I just mentioned. So as a result of that, and I should mention also that the dental costs have gone up to some extent, but that's more related, as far as I understand, to orthodontal kind of work. So the dental plan has gone up by 10.8%, and the health plan by 10.8%, and the dental plan by 14%. So if we look at these rates, I'm just showing you the last 3 years, but if you want to see a more detailed report, go on the website, and we go back, I think, to 2008 or something, so you can watch the progression. In 2014, and we see it around for a single family for both health and dental. So if I'm not mistaken here, the left, and these are our costs. So whatever costs you see here are matched by the university. And I believe that the left is health and the right is dental. So if you look down below, in 2014 it was 37, 62 for a single, now it's 47. Family was 74, now it's 92. And with dental, 20 to 24 and 44 to 53. So we've had significant increases. And these are monthly costs for us, by the way. So you multiply this times 12, and you end up with, roughly speaking, just over $1,000 a year for a family, over $500 a year for a single for health, and you can work out the rest for the dental. So overall, it's reasonable for the coverage that we get. We have very, very good coverage. And I think that's all I want to say about this. Edith, is there anything else we should say? Okay. And if anybody wants to know more, as I mentioned, you can check the webpage. And if you want more, you can contact Edith or myself or Nick. Now, some of the issues that are coming up have to do with the retirees. We've had a change in the composition of SBAC over the last year. We were joined by one of the unions, I guess it is now, AMUR. They joined us, and there represents the, I guess it's the research associates of the university. There was no decline in the committee, so we just added one more member. And there's been a formation of a retirees group called MURA, and they would like to have a seat on SBAC, and it makes sense because, if I'm not mistaken, more than 20% of the members of the plan are retirees. And it makes sense that they're at the table, particularly because their condition relative to everybody else will be changing this coming year. So they should have a say. What we've done through MAUT is given one of our seats to retirees, but we don't want to give up one of our three seats. And that's what the administration wants us to do. They'll take MURA on and give them a seat if we give up one seat. So with the other associations and unions, together we've petitioned the university, and a strong letter was written, endorsed by us all, indicating what the retirees actually bring and what they cost. And the fact is, they cost less than the non-retirees. The payouts are less. So it's not like whatever the illusion might be or represented in the future, we don't know, but the retirees are costing less than the fully employed members, and it's even going to become more favorable in the year or two ahead when people start paying the full amount. But, of course, the people that are already retired won't go to this higher rate. It'll be only those that start retiring after next year. So the cost to the entire plan is not a load by the retirees, it's a benefit by them. In any case, so we've had this kind of back and forth with the administration. This letter was sent in just a week or two ago, and we're hoping that they'll accept the change and add one retiree to the panel, and we'll keep our three members. We've had three members in the past, and we try to understand exactly why it is, but that would reflect a balance between faculty and non-faculty members on SBAC. Historically, and Edith knows this better than I, the other groups actually like us to be on the committee and have large numbers, first of all, because we have the information about things like health. It just happens that three of the members on the committee are all in the Faculty of Medicine, but that brings some expertise about health and dental costs. And the other issue is that we carry a little bit more weight with the administration. In any case, that's about the story at the moment. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer. Thanks.
Tony Deutsch, retired economist. I'd start out by thanking Al and Edith for obviously a very difficult job they're doing, and they're doing it well. Let me also share with you one principle that keeps running through our experience here. And that principle is that for a while, and I think anybody has been through the group life issue over the years knows, for a while we all have the same rates. We all contribute, and when we're young, we know very well that we are over-contributing relative to our actuarial cost in the expectation as we go down the road, someone else will pick up the burden and we will be subsidized. Lo and behold, one merry day, the university discovers that they would like to spend less money on this, spend $50,000 on getting a consultant to get something that, of course, about a dozen of us on this campus could tell them for free, and discover that the life insurance for old costs more actuarially than for the young. So what do we do? How do we save money? Well, it's very easy. We make the old, who have spent 30, 40 years subsidizing their elders, pay more. I was part of the generation that got stuck with this. There are other people in this room who have. And I suspect that as the same game can be played with a dental plan, the same game can be played with a health plan, simply because older people, generally speaking, have higher expenses, certainly on the health plan. When it comes to the dental plan, I suppose older people lose their teeth. At that point, you get a bit of a blip downwards. So what I really do want to share with you is the need to be alert to the fact that obviously, these things can be disaggregated and the burdens redistributed, and the university can save money at the cost of some unfairness to people who have borne burdens for many years. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony. I don't know if you realize, but Tony orchestrated much of our pension plan, and we have much to thank him for. I should mention to you all, and you may not know this, but some of you do, of course, was that this change that took place for retirees took place without the endorsement of SBAC and without the knowledge of any of the associations. It went straight to the straight to the board. We don't have any reps or even observers on the Human Resources Committee of the board, so we couldn't see it coming. It was the people on the board, when they get this information that's been processed by a subcommittee, and if it's represented that there's been proper consultation, which was mentioned, because there was consultation, there wasn't agreement, but there was consultation, they would simply endorse it, and that's what they did. Once it was endorsed by the board, everything changed, and we didn't know it. So, about a year or two later, I think when John Galati was the president, CASC, the Committee for Academic Salary Compensation, was reframed, and that all changes to either health, all benefits, health, dental, and pension, has to go through CASC as part of an overall compensation. So hopefully we won't be broadsided by this again. In response to what Tony's saying, you never know, because they could come back at us. But Edith, go ahead.
Edith Zurichter, I want to say something that's kind of parallel to what Tony is talking about. He's talking about trying to split up the community based on age. And we've always had a philosophy of universality in terms of our benefit plans, that we're all in it together and that we all share the costs, and you never know what's going to happen to you. And in terms of the health plans, that you can be very healthy when you're 25, and something can come around the corner that you can't expect. We need to also be careful about the possibility of trying to divide us in terms of the benefits plans. And it could be very easy to sort of dangle, oh, well, you're young, why don't we divide it up so that you pay less? You don't have any illnesses, so why don't we let you pay less and force people who have some type of thing, have diabetes, have multiple sclerosis, have heaven knows what, to pay more. That's not basically how we've ever felt about things here as academics at McGill. We've always felt that it was important that we are all together and we pay a single premium. And one of the things that people should be aware of is that there are, in contrast to previous years where there were very few new promising drugs, at the moment things have changed, and there's some very promising new drugs in the so-called pipeline that will be available for heart disease and cancer and some other serious things in the near future. They will be expensive, but compared to the savings in terms of hospital and other costs and the quality of life, they will be incredibly beneficial. And the cost of our health plan is shared 50-50 between us and the administration. So we need to be careful that they don't try to split us up and try to encourage some people to think, oh, we can pay less and divide up the health plan. I think it's very important for us to be conscious of this, and that we have an excellent health plan, and it's there for everyone.
Okay. That's it? Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Al. That takes us on to item 8 on the agenda, which says reports from executive and chair of the librarian section. And we'll try to get through this reasonably quickly. There's about half a dozen of them, starting with the president-elect. Terry, it's all yours.
Hi, everyone. I don't have too many things to tell you today, just a couple of things that I've been thinking about that one has been an abiding concern of mine for many years, and the other has recently come to the attention of the exec and council. So the first something I wrote about in the newsletter last time, a threat, a fundamental threat in my view to basic science funding or research funding in general to Canada. And I really want to push the administration to come up with a Made at McGill response. The second is we've recently been made aware of, well, I guess at the beginning of the summer, that Quebec's dual immigration system and the French language acquisition requirements have created a number of challenges for McGill professors that we also want the administration to deal with, and we want you to be aware of. So. You've read what I wrote, I hope, or if not, I'm gonna say it all again. But I think the notion that research should be driven by curiosity is being strongly shaped, altered, and pushed toward application. That's not just biomedical research or physical sciences, but it's also, I think, humanities research as well. That there's this push to apply almost everything we do, often long before we really understand what we're trying to apply. So current funding schemes now sort of are geared toward these applications rather than the generation of new knowledge per se. And the other thing I want to work on as long as I'm involved with MAUT is that there's an imbalance in funding that the administration sort of either refuses to acknowledge or refuses to deal with. They don't care, in my view, whether the money comes for equipment, whether it comes to pay salaries, or whether it comes to pay for the expenses associated with people using that equipment. So they're quite happy to have the race car, they're quite happy to have the pilot, but they don't really care if the fuel is there or not. So, and the other thing that they won't fund anymore, it's great to have the shiniest new car, but if your garage where all your tools are stored is broken, they won't pay for that. So they won't fund new replacements for core equipment, the lifeblood of departments, at least in the sciences. The other concern that is abiding, in my view, is that, and this is a bit better now in the second running of CIHR's foundation scheme, is that new investigators were grouped in with, you know, us old codgers, who have longer CVs, who have a longer time to develop a vision. So I think we have to protect our young faculty, and I want the administration to be aware of, you know, this downturn in funding is going to translate more onto them than it is onto us. One thing the administration could probably agree with me on is that CIHR and other granting agencies don't pay a lot of indirects. The money that we pay for direct costs of research and the money that they receive to keep the lights on in our labs. I suspect, after what we heard from the FQPPU, is that a lot of that money goes to keeping the lights on in classrooms because the provincial government doesn't pay for that very much anymore. So I'd like to be able to figure out all of that. And the budget information we heard today is eye-opening, and I think we're going to be making a lot of use of that. And then perhaps most substantially is that the federal government really wants to apply things, and they think that supporting industry initiatives rather than academic research directly is a better way toward economics for the country, right? So Al just told you that these new biologic drugs cost an arm and a leg to develop. A lot of that was on the public purse in labs like here at McGill. And I will say that insulin is a biologic, and it costs nothing. So the pharmaceutical industries are taking advantage of universities like McGill, who do a lot of their research for them. And again, it's public, it's public expenses, but private gain. But I won't go all communist on you now. So what I really want to do over the next few years is get the university, all the stakeholders in the university, to think about what that means for McGill and to have McGill lead the discussion rather than follow the vagaries of either industry or the government. So maybe we have an opportunity with the Trudeau government, but I suspect the honeymoon's going to be over pretty soon when funding decisions actually come to be made. There are already noises about, oh, there's not as much money as we thought, you know, that time-honored trope that every government uses. You would have thought that maybe they would do that, but they're going to do it. All right. The other issue that's come up more recently, challenges faced by academic staff who immigrate here from elsewhere to become our colleagues. NAFTA permits are tough on those who don't get permanent residency status right away. There are issues associated with extended health care insurance. They're allowed only to be out of the country for 21 days. Now, if your research is done in Asia or somewhere else, you're going to be expending a lot of your time doing your research there, but you're not covered. And also the point system for permanent residency, it clearly disadvantages women who don't have children who are older than 43. I think that's something we can make the administration sort of face up to and deal with. So they've already kind of done some things. They'll play with your tenure clock. They've made more continuing education opportunities available to learn French. It takes time to learn French. I still say the best way to learn French is to be forced to teach at the University of Montreal before you've ever learned a single word in French. And ask me about that when I've had a few drinks. So, but these changes don't go far enough. So we need to better inform our new hires about what they're facing. You know, let's give them the honest truth before they come here. We have to provide more flexible and better opportunities to learn French. We have to deal with the insurance issues. And we even after people get tenure here, they still have to deal with this permanent residency issue. So we need to protect tenured faculty that don't have permanent residency as much as untenured faculty. So we're going to take this up with the administration. The administration, at least, you know, in talking informally over lunch, is not unwilling to face these things. But I think we want to hold their feet to the fire. And I think we also want to have a forum through MAUT to kind of flesh out these things and maybe come up with our own solutions. I know we were going to talk about this last one as other business, but I'm saving Stefano from having to do that by doing it now. I think that's it for me. So thank you.
Sorry, before we wrap up on this, I just wanted to take a moment to introduce Oscar Castillo, because we now have a certified immigration consultant in at James Administration who is here. So just to introduce Oscar, who's behind the scenes. And Oscar is working with people who are already at McGill, but also new arrivals. And he and I work together on many issues. And one of the main things we're keen to do in our office is to ensure that new faculty in particular who come, who face issues with respect to French language acquisition, but also status questions, are guided through the process by Oscar, who is actually extremely busy given the volume, yeah. But at the same time, thinking about the implications, there are really big implications for people who come on tenure track if they reach renewal at a moment when they are still on a work permit. And that's precarious for the unit and also for the faculty members. Yeah. So I think it's really important to have this conversation.
That's great to hear. And I think we can actively say that we're willing to engage with you as much as you like. So thanks.
Any more questions for secretary? No. Nope. Okay, then the next report is from Al, again, VP Communications. Sorry.
So I'll be really brief about this, and it's a very brief report. So first of all, I just wanted to mention that I'm VP Communications, and we have a communications committee. It's made up of four other members. It includes Jen Gore, Andrea Miller-Nesbitt, Jane Aitkins, and Terry Hebert. Not anymore? He's off. Okay, so he's off. He has a resilient presence. But anyways, so the three of us, do we get anybody else on? I'm not sure. Anyways, but we're at least the four of us. In fact, we haven't met this year yet, but we will. And in fact, we probably will meet with the membership committee like we did last year. And that was a very useful experience. So just to catch up very, very quickly, about 3 or 4 years ago, we updated the web page. And since then, we've been trying to update the content of the web page, which hasn't gone quite as quickly. And so we've heard a little bit about this, and I won't go on too long, but Ken Hastings, Alan Nusseroyan, and Mark Richard have been working on a variety of things, one of which has been, as you've heard, the Constitution, which is almost ready to go. In fact, it is almost ready to go. It has to be put in. And then reviewing the committees, the standing committees, and what remains are the ad hoc committees that have to be updated. And we've modified the website to include more information, different pages for retirees, for librarian section, and we've integrated all the groups together under this one umbrella. Websites can always change and be updated and upgraded. So I would encourage any of you that have suggestions or comments or criticisms to send them to honor@maut.mcgill.ca, and they'll come to us. The newsletter was something we initiated last year for the first time. The newsletter became the actual annual report for the faculty, and it comes out on the average probably twice a semester and once in the summer. There'll be one more coming out, we hope, before Christmas. And what we try and do is keep you updated about what's happening. And then from the newsletter, we link to reports, whether the reports are posted on our website, FQPPU, CAUT, or whatever is relevant. I'm not doing things anymore that I have to say about that, except that we actually have a protocol for publishing this. And the editors are the three ladies who are on the communications committee that I mentioned above, Jen, Andrea, and Jane. And the last thing is the MAUT Communications Committee, and we'll just have to meet and get updated in the next little while. So that's it for me.
Are there any questions for Al, or he communicated pretty well, I guess? Okay. So, Alanish, VP Internal.
Thank you. The job of the VP Internal, what did I do? The VP Internal is generally responsible for MAUT participation in the internal affairs of the university. So there were four cluster of activities. Dave has spoken to most of them, so I won't get into the details. But I wanted to actually say something about the importance of my work with and the collaboration with other members of the executive and council and membership at large in addressing some of the tasks that are assigned to us. From the time that we have posted the consultation with MAUT bylaw, we have had increasing requests from different university bodies for input from MAUT. And this is a great thing, and we would like to be responsive. So that requires that more people get involved in helping us address these requests. And so we've been approaching beyond executive, beyond council, to our membership to help us. And I'm grateful to those of you who have already been very helpful in helping us address some of these requests. I also wanted to say that it's always a challenge to figure out to what extent do we survey people on a different issue. And on the one hand, we don't want to fill your inboxes with these surveys that are constant. On the other hand, we don't want to make decisions on our on your behalf where you need to provide that input. So if there are ideas and suggestions as to how we can balance this better, I'd be grateful if you could let us know. And basically, those are the points I wanted to make. The report will be posted, I suppose, soon. I've submitted it, so it'll be posted on the website. If you have any questions that you want to ask, I'm happy to answer them. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Next up is Axel.
Are there any bullet points here? No. Okay. I'll do it off the top of my head. So my job is to maintain external relations, including, or in particular, with the FQPPU and CAUT. And now that Martin has given his fantastic presentation, I do not, from now on, have to sell the FQPPU to you anymore. We now know what they can do for us, and they do a lot more than that. Martin is basically keeps up to date a report this thick, this size, of which we have a copy, if you would want to take a look, on which the data that he's shown us is based. It's full of extremely fascinating material on how we are funded by faculty, by professors and lecturers, and on and on and on. It's really quite an interesting and important document for us to have, and you have access to it through us. The FQPPU has a new president, Jean-Marie Lafortune, who has taken a number of new initiatives as well. They have revived their biannual bulletin, which comes out in French and in English, which you can access on their website. By the way, I can be very brief here because all of this is in my report, which I think is already online with the links and so on. And as you will have noticed as well, all these kinds of items turn up in the newspaper, in the newsletter that Al puts out twice or three times per semester, where you can also find them, and then you can back search the website for these items as well. The FQPPU is also organizing a very interesting, this seems to be the topic of the month, maybe the year, or unfortunately probably the decade, on managerial administration practices in the universities. They're organizing a workshop as part of ACFAS, the French Language Science Congress, next May, a day and a half of discussions about the managerialist tendencies in the university administrations. CAUT is also organizing its Harry Crow Foundation, which is a foundation that is concerned with academic freedom in particular, is also organizing, I believe you can find it on the website, but it's I think February 11th and 12th, a workshop on academic freedom in the managerialist academia or something of that nature. So this is really a topic that is on everybody's mind. Brandon is going to that, among others, and John Galati. This is a big topic, obviously, and I think it might be an interesting idea in the near future that we organize a forum of some sort ourselves on managerialist and corporatist kinds of tendencies in university administration as a topic for a forum. For the FQPPU, they have revived their Guy Rocher Prize, which is to be awarded to an individual who has shown exceptional merit in defending collegiality, academic freedom, democracy, and access in the university system of Quebec. They have reconstituted that committee, and they're asking us for somebody who would be willing to sit on that committee on our behalf. They want to have at least one member from one of the Anglophone universities, and so we're asked to nominate someone. I'm happy to take any nominations. Or Honor are happy to take any nominations if you wish to nominate yourself or one of your colleagues. As part of its campaign, which Martin sort of alluded to, its campaign to, as they say in French, valoriser academic life and professor, the role of the professor, valoriser does not have an English counterpart. I looked it up. It says glorify, which is not quite. If only we could. So they have, as part of their campaign, they're putting out these really neat short videos profiling a particular professor, usually a fairly young professor, kind of appealing individual who is very successful. And so they're making these short videos, and they're using these on various media, most of which I have never heard of, but they, you know, they get around, obviously. And they're asking us to suggest a few people that might be the subject of one of these videos. So if you could think of one of your younger colleagues, or maybe not so young colleagues, who would be a good subject for, and a willing subject for the making of such a video, then please let us know. Both the CAUT now and the FQPPU have reestablished or created massive salary databases that are now accessible. This was partly at our urging. We have persistently urged them to do this, and they are now both accessible. And there's a problem with the FQPPU's members only or accès réservé link, but we are solving that problem with them. But you should be able to access those data on your own on both websites. What else should I mention? Just one tiny item: the Quebec government has formed a year and a half or so ago un groupe national sur la formation doctorale, if I'm not mistaken, groupe de consultation or something like that. I can't remember exactly what the title is. In any case, they too were looking for an Anglophone, or not necessarily Anglophone, but someone representing the English-speaking university community to sit on that committee, and Paul Yaknin of the English department has shown that he's willing to be nominated for that. He will not necessarily be an MAUT representative. He represents himself, but we are very happy that he's nominated for that committee, and we would be very happy to have him sit on that committee and report back to us. And the other items you'll see in the report or in the newsletter. Thanks. one more piece of advertising. The FQPPU has had these fora on la condition professorale, our conditions of work, and they've put out three little, very appealing little booklets on various aspects of our work situation, and they're now all available in the English as well. One is called The Juggling Act, Thriving or Surviving. The other one is called Research and Creation, Conducting Quality Research and Creating or Overproducing. And then there is one on Collegiality and Management, Organizing or Being Organized. And so you're welcome to a copy of any or all of these three. We have a number of them at the office of the Honor has them. She's pointing out she has piles of them. So if you're willing to, if you're interested in having one of these, then be our guest. Yes, sir, you had a question.
Alex, my name is Hamida Tamal. I remember when I was younger, our colleagues, our parental groups were always saying that our children are complaining about us being dictators. The children are saying, Dad, Mom, you're dictating. The reason that I suggested that is that our governance is based on our board of governors. Board of Governors are all very successful CEOs, rich, influential, and they make all the decisions for us. Do you expect them to go away from what they do on a daily basis as corporate CEOs and not transform universities towards more of managerialism? That's the question. Excuse me. My suggestion is that I have been here for the last 35 years. We have been talking about the governance of the university. The composition of the board that I can testify to has become more managerial, more corporate. And now we are talking about collegial governance. We are also talking about less of managerialism. I don't think that's something that is going to happen within Montreal. Definitely not McGill and Concordia. And I should say has gone the same way. Mm. I'm not really qualified to comment on other universities in Quebec, but not only they have the CEOs, but they have government members. So this is not a job that McGill alone can do. Perhaps something beyond McGill, some sort of association like CET and FPPQ can attack. So that should be, if I may suggest, on your agenda, on external associations' agenda. Thank you.
Right. Well, I can't possibly disagree with what you're saying. You're saying this in the spirit of what I just said. I think it's much more widespread than just McGill or a few universities in Quebec or anywhere else. Just anecdotally, I have a good friend from my high school days in Holland who became a philosopher of history but spent the last half of his career writing tirades against the corporatist and managerial tendencies of Dutch universities. And he's becoming sort of an international star in this whole field because it's not just in Holland, it's in Britain, it's in Germany, it's in and so on and so forth in the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a very general trend. Whether or not it can be stopped, I don't know, but it's certainly worth trying. That we have some minor successes in the last few years that we can point to on behalf of the MEOT, and in getting a slightly better, a more open administration, or a top administrator.
Axel, let me thank you. I'm Tony Deutsch. Again, still. Axel, let me thank you for doing all this. And I know how frustrating dealing with some of these organizations can be. The purpose of this intervention is to say something about the CAUT. Not many people know that the CAUT was founded in the room adjoining back in the early 50s to deal with Harry Crow, the man whose name you have cited. Harry Crow was a professor at a then church-affiliated university whose private correspondence was intercepted, and on the basis of that, they fired him. A clear case for academic freedom. However, they couldn't save him, but don't worry too much about Harry Crow because he later became a dean at York. Now, the question is, what does CAUT do for us now? We have been transmitting immense amounts of money through the years to CAUT. CAUT was an organization born at a time when the provinces had no involvement in universities. CAUT set itself up as a lobby with the federal government, which then occasionally made grants to universities, to speak on our behalf. Perhaps it was right to do so. Perhaps it even had some effectiveness in academic freedom cases. Now, the problem is that all of these powers and effectiveness have passed to the provincial associations. CAUT is not really a federation of provincial associations. CAUT is a body of its own, which, of course, makes essentially declarations coinciding with the view of a particular political party, which I shan't identify, but the clue to it is that they never managed to form a federal government. That's all good and well, but I think it behooves our membership the two or three of our MAUT people should sit down, take a very dispassionate view of this, and evaluate our costs and benefits that we get from continued membership of CAUT. Now, I know what the answer would have been when I last looked at these things, but things do change. So I think it's not inappropriate to evaluate major expenditure items from time to time. And that's the end of my plea.
Well, I'm certainly not averse to having a debate or a discussion, in-depth discussion about whether we should continue our memberships of various organizations and what they bring in. As I have made clear, I think FQPPU pays for its dues. In the case of CAUT, of course, we shouldn't forget that we... How much money did we get for the Chowdhury case? $300,000 that we didn't have ourselves. We received from the Academic Freedom Fund of the CAUT to help support Chowdhury in his case. So they have been of some use to us in the fairly recent past. Whether we should, whether the other services that they provide are worth the money that we're paying them for, I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to discuss, and I'm perfectly willing to put that on the table. Thank you. Yes, Mark.
Mark Richard from Libraries. If I could provide a partial answer to the point that Tony Deutsch raised. I don't think there are many librarians, I don't think you will find many librarians at McGill who are not convinced of the value of CAT, as a number of people here may or may not be aware. About 10 years ago, the McGill librarians at McGill came under very severe attack from the former director of libraries, went through a period of 5 years where their academic freedom, their academic working editions, and various other things were just subject to outrageous abuses. We tried to resolve the matter through MAUT. Those endeavors did not prove successful. Ultimately, we went to CAUT. CAUT set up a commission of inquiry, which came to McGill. The report they issued is, of course, confidential, but suffice to say that not long after the report was submitted, the Dean of Libraries in question, the administration indicated the Dean of Libraries would not be putting her name forward for reappointment, and indeed that Dean of Libraries left shortly thereafter. Frankly, this organization, or at the very least the librarian section, owes a huge debt of gratitude to CAUT. As far as MAT in general is concerned, I believe there was a legal case of a professor who was summarily fired, and CAUT provided in fact, the accountant referred to it, CAUT and the Academic Freedom Fund poured huge amounts of money into defending this McGill
the one
professor.
I just referred to, yes.
Yes.
Right. Well, so, Tony, the discussion has started. For the other side, absolutely.
So I have a comment and a question. A comment addresses Tony's issue. It seems to me, given the peculiar position that McGill is in as an Anglophone university within a Francophone province, that we not only should be part of a federal institution, but also part of the provincial. Of the universities in Quebec, my understanding is that McGill and Concordia are the only ones who belong to both institutions, but I think that's appropriate and ambitious. And I think that's appropriate. That's my comment. My question, of the AUCC used to systematically gather information on salaries that could be used in planning and would be disseminated certainly among MAUT and other comparable bodies. So the question is, FQPPU and CAUT gathering information in a systematic and comprehensive way such that it can be used for those planning purposes and it will be convincing to university administrations?
To the extent possible, yes. So the FQPPU has put together a huge database essentially collecting all the collective agreements in the province.
right. And it takes some research to actually find out what the figures are in there, but you can find the salary figures that we would need in order to compare ourselves to the others in that database. Always a couple of years behind, of course, unfortunately, but there's not much we can do about that. The AUCC's database was like that, too. The CAUT now also has a database that they are trying to keep up to date and expand in order to replace the AUCC's database. Yes, that is what they're working on. I haven't looked at it recently, but I'm told that it's in pretty good shape already. So yes, those will be our resources. Absolutely. Did I do that? Right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Axel. Okay, we're running a little behind, so I'm going to try to move on fairly quickly. Next item is Ken on finance.
Okay, thank you. I think I really can finish in 90 seconds, because our auditor gave the full report to you, and everything looks good. Things are stable from a year-to-year basis. Bottom line is that we expect next year to be much like this year and the year before. We are now have accumulated assets of about $640,000, and we expect to, by in a year from now, have about $740,000 or $750,000. And although our auditor thinks we need more, I think we're at a point where we have to have this discussion internally. What kind of a accumulated reserve do we need? So this discussion will be happening. And what is the annual level of annual surplus that we need apart from that? In other words, what's a safe level, what's a safe margin to operate at on a year-to-year basis? And lastly, in view of these financial issues, what about, what should we take a look at our membership fees, perhaps reduce them? Should we take a look at are the activities we're doing, et cetera, et cetera? So these are things that are ongoing, but basically the picture is good, and that's all I think I need to say for now. But I'll take any questions.
Thanks, Ken. And moving right along, the next question is Eamon and the librarian section.
Okay, so I'll try to beat Ken's time. My full report's available on the website, so I'm just going to just highlight a few brief things. As the name suggests, the librarian section represents McGill's librarians, and I'd like to report we have a very strong and engaged membership. We have 52 members as of the beginning of this month, out of a possible, 64. So we have over 80% participation in MAUT and in the LS. Joining me on executive this year, we have Jill Borov, who is the chair-elect, Tara Mawini, who is the past chair, and Jennifer Garland, who is secretary-treasurer. We meet monthly to deal with the issues that arise, the ongoing issues that arise that are important to librarians. And we meet almost as frequently with the dean of libraries, for informal talks on these issues that come up. So this year, things we focused on are the merit process, sabbatic leaves, support for research activities, the establishment of criteria for promotion to full librarian, which are currently non-existent, and also for filling vacancies on library committees. MAUT-LS has two committees. The Professional Issues Committee is an advisory committee to the executive. They've put together, based on the results of a survey they did last year, a workshop, which should be held in December, on research approaches and methodologies. And that's going to be given by two professors from the School of Information Studies, Joan Bartlett and Ilya Friesen. In my report, I go on, I mentioned, the librarian section, there's a lot of members that are active outside of just the librarian section on council, on various committees of the MAUT, so we're active in that way as well. And I guess just to finish off, just an announcement that our own fall general meeting is November 20th from noon to 2, which is a week from tomorrow. So if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them. If not, we can move along. Thank you.
Okay, the next report is membership committee, Stefano.
Thank you, David. Stefano Algeri from Music. On behalf of the membership committee, Tara Mawini, Ken Hastings, Terry Hebert, and until the early fall, Deborah Titone. Want to thank council and executive for their support in our pushing and promoting the recent welcoming gathering that occurred in September, the apple picking in October. All of the details regarding finances and attendees has been sent to council and I believe is on the web. Seems like we came out, we increased our numbers of people coming to the events, and we even managed to save some money, I believe, on the apple picking, quite a substantial amount. One of our initiatives is to promote membership, and if the presentations from beginning with David and finishing with Eamon didn't point out the importance of such an organization in our time. As we say in, when we hear a great singer, even a deaf person would know that's a great singer. Well, even a deaf and a blind person would know the importance of MAUT in today's world. If not us at McGill University, who? So we're going to be reaching out. Our committee is like every other committee and every other person at McGill, overworked and underpaid. But we're going to be reaching out to the other eight faculties that are not represented on our committee and to target personally members there to help recruit. We can only do so much, and the personal touch is really so important. So we're going to do our best to reach out to colleagues on various committees to be, shall we say, associate members or adjunct members of our membership committee to help promote and inform our colleagues of what MAUT is doing. As I said last year, and I didn't mean to take Mr. Churchill's name in vain, but never has so much been done by so few for so many. There are a lot of people profiting greatly from the fine work that the members of MAUT and the committees are doing, and we want to increase the membership because we have a lot of talent out there, and to help bring in very bright and energetic people to our community. McGill does, MAUT does so much to enhance the work and the overall health of the McGill community, university life, not just for students, but there isn't one facet of our life at McGill University that MAUT does not take a very active and a very competent part in. So I would ask all of those who are listening either via camera or those in the room, please, to help. It's a real domino effect to spread the word, to help us help you. Just a reminder that this is not my diploma, but is the next MAUT in conjunction with Nicholas Girin here at the faculty club, who we owe a great deal to. In helping co-sponsor these past events. Our next event will be on January 17th, Winter Magic, a brunch from a couple of hours on 10:30 in the morning until 1 o'clock. It's just for our membership, as opposed to the first two events were for faculty and their family, members of MAUT and non-members, and then the Oktoberfest. So we're slowly, and this particular event is just for our membership. So this will be, we'll post this somewhere, Honora, in the very front of the building. So we hope to see you all there. Seating is limited, so please contact early if you would like, and bring your children of all ages. White-haired children, too, hopefully. So if anyone has any questions, I'd be glad to answer. Thank you very much. Thank you, David.
Okay. Moving along to the older kids. Gary, retirees section.
So I represent the retirees, so we can come last. After all, we have nothing to do. Honor, there's my report is there. It's very short and sweet. We've been doing our traditional activities. In particular, for instance, this fall we arranged a luncheon in the faculty club. It's a very, very excellent speaker. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there. But apparently it was very, very good. And he was a Booker Prize nominee. So you can imagine, you know, he's a very talented person. And the Retirees Affairs Committee, or the Executive Committee for the Retirees Section, was reconstituted this year. So we brought in some really younger retired people, like James Colton, who's sitting there, very enthusiastic, and Antti Pudgeon and Esther Lopmeyer. You know, with some of them, I have worked with some of them on the MEAT Executive. They're very enthusiastic. They want to bring in new energy. It's very important. And we are looking forward to many interesting activities. So that those of you who are on the verge of retiring may really think about retiring. But don't retire. If you want to plan retirement, come to me. I'll guide you properly. The MURA, they talked about MURA, the McGill University Retirees Association, which came into existence last fall. And it is now, last summer, in fact. And it has a properly constituted executive committee and board. There's one member there sitting. And they have some very ambitious activities and so on. And to enable MURA to properly function, to survive, etc., along with the past chairman of the retirees section, John Dealey, who actually started the retirees section, and myself, we negotiated a deal with the MURA executive, whereby for a fixed sum of amount that they are paying, going to pay this year to the MURA, which will be useful for their budget, all the members of the retirees section will automatically be members of MURA without paying any additional dues. And we do hope to make some kind of more formal, long-lasting arrangement. And that's one of the reasons why I accepted to continue as the chair of the retirees section. I have done enough. I don't want to continue. But I agreed to do it because this is a, you know, initial period for the MURA, and it should exist. It should survive. And I didn't know that I wanted to add SBAC representatives for retirees, and Al talked about it. Actually, Al's figure was not completely correct. As of last year, or a year before, I don't remember, there were 7,000 people approximately, 6,900 or something, who were on the health and dental benefits plan, health plan particularly, of which a whopping 1,720, which is almost a quarter, not 20%, but 25% of the people in the healthcare insurance are retirees. Not all of them are academic, but they are retirees. And therefore, it's only fair that they have a voice in the SBAC. Though I am ambivalent about it, whether the MEAT should have 3 seats and the retirees should have 1, or the 2-on-1, I think it will eventually sort it out by itself. But I think they should accept the policy that the retirees should be represented. Thank you.
Are there any questions for Gary? Okay. That takes us to the end of the reports and actually gets us to the agenda item called Other Business. We'd originally put this one on for 2 reasons. One is because we wanted to bring it up, and the other one was we felt it might attract a few more people to the meeting. Unfortunately, I've now run the meeting long enough that anybody we might have attracted has left. So I guess people have to actually work around this place and teach students. We can continue discussing this if we want, but I think Terry did a terrific job earlier on, and I think covered everything we wanted to say at that point. Stefano, is there anything you have? Okay. Unless anybody wants to talk any more about this stuff, and you've got about 2 seconds to say yes. Good? Great. Gone. Okay. The last one, again, it says open discussion, but I think probably who's left probably wants to get the cocktails and discuss it around there. I just wanted to bring up again something I had in my report, which was that we have been invited into this cyclical review of the information technology services, and all of us use these things. All of us suffer from them. And I use the word suffer appropriately, I think. We really would like to find out what you want to see changed with these guys. We get a chance once every, what is it, about 7 years, cyclical reviews, I think. So this is it. Somewhere in the next 3 or 4 weeks, we need to hear from you, and then you can be silent for the next 7 years and live with whatever happens. So there will be a survey coming out. We'd like everybody to fill it in, and we'll try to get more than just you guys to do it. And if you've got any comments to bring back, bring them back to us as soon as you can. Okay, so there's the official information. Survey's there. You've got another couple of weeks to fill it out. Please fill it out. Get us information back. And anybody who really feels like they want to meet with this cyclical review committee, we have a date booked. I think it's December 2nd, and it's about a three-quarter hour, an hour session. So if anybody wants to come, and I'd like to have some volunteers, we may not be able to fit everybody in the room, but I'd be happy to have more volunteers than one or two. So I've already had a few people come up to me and say they'd like to be involved. So if anybody else feels like they should be, please do that. I don't know, that's all I've got to say on this. Anybody want to bring up anything else? Silence. Probably means you've had enough of this meeting. Okay. In that case, the last thing here is an adjournment. I need a motion to adjourn. I've got okay. Okay, thanks everybody, and thank you for coming, and cocktails outside, and we'll see you in the spring.